Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, podcast listeners. I'm Connor, and welcome to episode 5 of Intelligence Squared Business. This week, we have David Epstein, author of Range, Why Generalists Triumph in a Specialized World. It's a fascinating conversation in which David spoke to the economist and broadcaster Linda Yu about how from artists and writers like William Shakespeare to leading sports people like Roger Federer and Serena Williams, generalists tend to be more successful and have more fulfilling careers than experts. It's a fascinating conversation, and if you do enjoy it, you can find a link for David's book in the podcast description. A quick reminder, if you are enjoying Intelligence Squared Business, please share and tell all your friends about this new podcast strand. But now, let's go to the episode.
We shouldn't reward people for forging ahead if they learn things that say they should pivot. Everyone knows Serena Williams played a lot as a girl. I got to talk to her last year. I'd been a sports reporter. I didn't even know. She told me I did taekwondo, ballet, gymnastics. This isn't to say that we don't need specialists, of course not. But I do think there's all this like cultural mythology that sort of makes people feel bad about having broad interest.
Hello, I'm Linda Yu, an economist and broadcaster. Welcome to this episode of the Intelligence Squared Business Podcast. I'm joined by David Epstein to discuss his new book, Range, Why Generalists Triumph in a Specialized World. David is a New York Times bestselling author who also wrote The Sports Gene. He has worked as an investigative reporter for ProPublica and a senior writer for Sports Illustrated. Welcome, David. It's lovely to have you here to speak with you about this terrific book. I'm going to just kick off and ask you, what led you to write this book? And after reading it, I felt it had personal resonance for you, didn't it?
It definitely did. I mean, I think even when I don't realize it at the time, in retrospect, I think a lot of my writing projects come out of things I'm curious about that I see in my own life. And particularly, though, the genesis of Range came out of my first book, The Sports Gene, where I sort of criticized some of the science, the rigor of the science underlying the so-called 10,000 hours rule, or the deliberate practice framework, as scientists call it. And that brought me into a debate with Malcolm Gladwell at something called the MIT Sloan Sports Analytics Conference. And we were brought there to debate about the best way to develop athletes. And I'd never met him before, and he's obviously pretty clever, and I didn't want to get embarrassed on stage. So I went through his writing to try to guess what he would argue. And I saw his writing about how, you know, important it was to specialize early and narrowly. And so when we got to that debate, I made a big point of the data showing that, in fact, athletes who go on to become elite usually don't do that. They have this sort of so-called sampling period where they do sort of a variety of physical activities. They gain these broad general skills, learn about their interests and abilities, and delay specializing until later than peers who plateau at lower levels. And when we were coming off the stage, he said, you know, that data really didn't comport with my thinking. Like, what, you want to go on a run tomorrow when we're both back home in New York and we'll talk about it more? And so we became running buddies and we would talk about this stuff on our own time. Called it the Roger versus Tiger problem, which turned out to be the introduction of the book, came directly out of our discussions. And so just as we were talking about it, I started to think about it, whether what we were seeing in sports could really be just an analogy for other domains of work in the world. And so I started getting interested in all these other domains and seeing which of those sort of fit that surprising pattern in sports and which didn't. And that was the genesis of the project.
And And for you personally, you sampled, didn't you? You didn't specialize early.
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, you know, in sports and in life, right? I did like American football, basketball, baseball, but cross country track and sports. I ran track in college, but when I was like 16, I knew exactly what I wanted to do. I was going to be a test pilot. I was going to go to the United States Air Force Academy. I was then going to be an astronaut. I didn't do any of that stuff. Now I have no idea. Like I've gotten almost linearly less knowing what I'm doing as I've gotten older. And in university, I was training to be a scientist. So I have a master's degree in environmental sciences. But I decided that, you know, that wasn't kind of a fit for me. It wasn't good. You know, some economists call it match quality, the degree of fit between my interests and abilities and the work I was doing. And I sort of decided, because of some kind of personal events, to try to merge my interests in sports and science. And at the time, right about sudden cardiac death in athletes, because I'd had a training partner who had died at the end of a race. So I took my sort of scientific background, where I was like very normal. As I was like living up in the Arctic, you know, doing research in the Arctic tundra. And I was very normal, I would say, around other scientists. But then you take those skills, move them over to like a sports magazine. And suddenly, you know, I realized how unique that was, even though it was ordinary in one area. And so actually that attuned me to something that I just continued to do throughout my career, which is take skills that were sort of ordinary in one milieu and transport them to somewhere where suddenly they were seen as like, you know, innovative and creative. And so I did realize that that was something that started helping me. And so I've zigzagged like crazy and I'm still doing that. I still like truly have no idea what I'm going to be when I grow up.
That's actually a very good intro to your book, because it's all about this, you know, thinking differently, I think, about how you undertake your career. And I love this quote that you start with. You give the full quote: a jack of all trades is a master of none, but oftentimes better than a master of one. So tell us about this quote and the premise of your book a bit more.
Yeah, well, that quote, so usually we only hear jack of all trades, master of none. And I thought it's kind of culturally telling that we lop off the end of the quote, which is oftentimes better than master of one. This isn't to say that we don't need specialists, of course not. Mm-hmm. But I do think there's all this like cultural mythology that sort of makes people feel bad about having broad interests. And in fact, the first use of jack of all trades as an insult, the first written use at least, so the first one we have record of, was Johannes Factotum in New Latin. And it was written by a playwright who was insulting another young playwright who didn't have formal higher education, who was really a poet who was trying to write plays and trying to act and help run a theater company and copy scripts. And so he said, this, you know, this loser is trying to do it all. And that loser was William Shakespeare. So he was the butt of the first jack of all trades insult. But I think that's sort of common, because if you look through sort of especially, you know, science and technology, innovation history, but also literature and the arts, these people who are coming with an unusual background that often change a field are at first denigrated by the people who are sort of, you know, the sort of status quo standard bearers in the field. And so that quote kind of came to be representative to me of that. But we forget the past half of it, just like we only focus on stories of precocity, right? So in the book, when I open up with Roger Federer and Tiger Woods, where Roger Federer did all these sports as a kid and delayed specializing, and Tiger obviously specialized early, those are both examples of success. I didn't dispute that at all, obviously. But everyone knows the Tiger Woods story. And even though Federer is just as famous as an adult, nobody knows his story, even though it's the norm, according to the science, not the exception, right? Everyone knows Serena Williams played a lot as a girl. I got to talk to her last year. I'd been a sports reporter. I didn't even know. She told me I did taekwondo, ballet, gymnastics, track and field. I learned how to throw a football for my overhand serve. I worked at a sports magazine. I'd never even heard that. Or, you know, we think of the Mark Zuckerberg as like the young prodigy, right? He said young people are just smarter when he was 22. He doesn't say that anymore. But last year, MIT and the U.S. Census Bureau released research showing that the average age, in the U.S. at least, of a founder of a fast-growing tech startup on the day of founding is 45.4. But it's just like all these other stories where we focus on these exceptions because they're dramatic and they're these tidy narratives, and we ignore what the research says is actually the norm. Even though there's a huge amount of variability, I think it's important to know what's typical when we're all focused on these exceptions.
I found that aspect of your book absolutely fascinating, because you're right. We think of the norm as actually the Tiger Woods, the kind of young, you know, startup. And I've certainly seen equivalent studies in other countries where, you know, your entrepreneurs on average of fast growing startups are actually in their 40s, people who've had experience, and therefore they've decided to strike out on their own. And yet that's not our perception at all. So I found all of this to be a good reason, by the way, David, to write a book. So let's talk more about it and change perceptions. So I want to ask you about the cult of the head start and the story of the Polgar sisters and chess. Of course, coincidentally, The Queen's Gambit on Netflix is garnering a huge amount of attention right now.
Yeah, it's a really good show. I watched it, you know, I think deservedly so. I think like the cinematography is beautiful. The acting is wonderful. But it's interesting because I just the other day did a Q&A where I was the question asker with a guy named John Urschel, who used to play in the NFL. Again, you know, American football, and at the same time started his math PhD at MIT at the same time while he was in the NFL. And now he's a mathematician finishing his, he decided to retire from the NFL after he had a pretty severe concussion. And he's finishing his PhD in math at MIT. And he's also, he's become a good chess player, and his best friend is one of the best chess players in the United States. And he was talking about Queen's Gambit and saying how he gets bothered sort of by the portrayal of genius in a lot of media, where it's like just this like bolt of lightning out of the blue, right? It's like someone who just has this incredible talent right away, because that's often not exactly how it works, right? It's probably not quite as rare as those things make it look, but it's like usually a slower process. There are cases that are these sort of bolts out of the blue, but usually it's more someone gets interested in something, builds a little skill, maybe they learn a little faster than they thought, and it's usually much more fits and starts and all sorts of luck and coincidences. And there is some of that luck in Queen's Gambit for sure. But I think it is just like one more pebble on this huge pile that suggests either you got it early or you don't got it at all. And the fact is, development is very nonlinear, and that's usually not the way these things look. And chess, by the way, is also in many ways, I think, a poor example. So to go back, you mentioned the Polgar story that's in the book. So let me talk about that, because in some ways it would be interesting to people who've been watching Queen's Gambit. So they should go watch the Polgar variant, which is a great documentary about the Polgar sisters, where these three sisters whose father, Laszlo, decided to train them in chess in a very technical manner from a young age in Hungary. And really, he didn't care about chess so much. He just wanted to show that any child with a head start in so-called deliberate practice being like not playing, it's very focused, coached, focused on error correction, that any kid could become a genius in anything with a head start and deliberate practice. And in fact, two of his daughters went on to become grandmaster players. And one of them went on to become the highest ranked woman in the world, Judith Polgar. And so this showed up like the Tiger Woods story in a whole bunch of best-selling books saying like, this is the key. You just need this early start. And the fact is, in chess, it actually is really beneficial to get an early start, because chess is based on repetitive patterns that you have to start recognizing almost like unconsciously. And if you haven't started studying those by age 12, the chance of a competitive player reaching international master status, which is one down from grandmaster, drops from about 1 in 4 to about 1 in 55. You have to start doing that. But that's also why it's so easy to automate, right? Because it's based on these recurring patterns that computers are much better at. And so it's actually a really bad model in many ways of most of the things like that we want to learn in the rest of the world, or the Tiger Woods, like golf being the most famous example. Golf is almost a uniquely bad model of almost everything else that humans want to learn. So there's nothing wrong with those stories until we extrapolate them, which is mainly what we do with them, right? So golf and chess, these are very far on the spectrum of what the psychologist Robin Hogarth called kind learning environments, where kind learning environments are those that have repetitive rules that never change, patterns that repeat, goals and next steps are clear, feedback is quick and accurate, work next year will look like work last year. On the other end of the spectrum are what he called wicked learning environments, where next steps and goals may not be handed to you. Rules may not be clear, they may change. feedback may be delayed or inaccurate. Patterns don't just repeat. Work next year won't look like work last year. So like, which one of these sounds like the world that most of us who aren't like pro golfers or chess players are living in, right? Some of both, but increasingly more of the wicked. And so it's not that I have a problem with the Polgar story, and they are, by the way, I should just say they, in what little interaction I've had with the Polgar sisters, they seem like lovely, well-adjusted people. I don't think this is a story of like, you know, kids being turned into monsters by an overbearing father. But the problem is when we extrapolate those lessons to these other domains where the lessons don't apply well.
Yeah, absolutely. Fascinating. I recommend everybody get David's book and watch The Queen's Gambit too, as well as the book.
Can't go wrong.
I want to delve into each of the different parts of this. So you include so many fascinating studies. So one of the ones that you include is, compared to other scientists, Nobel laureates, so these are the people at the top of their profession, normally in science and medicine and even economics, are at least, and this is quite extraordinary, 22 times more likely to be an amateur dancer, magician, or performer. So say more about how having range helps these high performers break old patterns, which then helps them succeed, versus people who are more specialized. Oh, and try to add in that Steve Jobs story as well, because I think that was also brilliant.
Okay, yeah, so as magicians, writers, musicians, all these other sorts of performers, that Nobel laureate scientists were much more likely to have these sorts of hobbies compared to typical scientists. And not only that, but in other studies of engineers who made creative contributions, compared to sort of engineers of similar technical skill, they tended to have aesthetic hobbies outside of work. And again, in the work of a professor named Abby Griffin, who studies so-called serial innovators, these are people who make like repeated creative contributions to their organizations. She found they tend to have more hobbies than their peers. They read more and more widely. They have a need to learn outside their discipline. They have lots of people in their network who are outside of their own discipline. All these sorts of things that are just, you know, they just have like wider, longer antennas for the world. And it seems like in the creativity research, a lot of researchers use different terms for what this is. Some call it like network of enterprise. They have sort of a lot of things that they're interested in. But it seems to help avoid so-called cognitive entrenchment, where you sort of get stuck. And again, there are different words for this, like functional fixedness means people who, you know, they're only able to use a certain type of tool the same way over and over, and they forget it can be used in different ways. Or the Einstellung effect, once you've been accustomed to a certain type of solution for a problem, you get stuck in it, even when it doesn't work for new problems anymore. And so these are all forms of this cognitive entrenchment, where with experience, you become, you know, with sort of specialized experience, you become much more efficient in certain things. But there's also a trade-off. You can think of it almost like an internet browser, right? It's like, if you go to the same sites all the time, you'll get cookies and you can go to those sites even faster, but you're sacrificing some sort of flexibility for searching more broadly. And so in all this creativity research, it just showed up over and over and over that the people who made contributions tended to have like multiple streams of interest, often that didn't have anything to do with one another. Like they would have, seemingly didn't have one to do with one another. They would say that it would give them insights into some of their work. And so I think it suggested that if we want to avoid sort of getting stuck in the same thought patterns, you want to have ideas coming from places that aren't just in your direct line of sight every day. Otherwise you increasingly know the same things that the people in your, you know, that are around you know, basically.
And that's where the Steve Jobs story comes in, isn't it?
Oh, right. The Steve Jobs story. Right. So he famously said, I mean, Steve Jobs was sort of obviously Apple has very important specialists, but he was kind of a master generalist in many ways. And he famously said that he audited a calligraphy class because he was interested in aesthetics. And this gave him the idea to have different typefaces, right? And that led to all computers having all these different typefaces and a whole bunch of aesthetics that grew out of that. So it was just this auditing this class in calligraphy that gave him an idea that really changed the aesthetics of personal computing. And he had a bunch of things like that where he would like pick up some, he would go and browse stores, you know, for kitchen supplies or something and see like, you know, I like the way this like blender fits in this spot or whatever. Maybe we can do. So he sort of saw the world in the way I think like Saul Bellow saw when he like walked among people. He was like shopping for parts of people to put in his characters and books. And Steve Jobs was like shopping for little aesthetic things when he went around the world. And so I think he was just like, I think that was a common theme of what a lot of these, like these Nobel laureates would do, is they really were just curious about the world. Like they were always, even in their personal time, they were like shopping for new ideas. And sometimes those would end up influencing their main work.
You illustrate the importance of range, the title of your book, using Team GB success at the 2012 Olympics. So tell us that story.
Yeah, so this is, I particularly use this because I was sort of responding to a British writer who I like, by the way, who said that, blamed some of the problems of British governance on moving like different ministers into different positions and said like, this makes no more sense than moving Tiger Woods to play hockey or something like that. And, you know, I think the extreme end of that argument would be, well, you should just have like a king and they should just like stay there all the time, right? Because then they'll get the most experience, but never mind that. So, but I thought it was interesting that Team GB, as he made that sports analogy, I had some insight into some of what was going on to try to, I mean, Britain, quite frankly, had gone from being a world sporting powerhouse to being very mediocre for decades, and then has bounced back in a big way. And a lot of that had to do with these programs that were set up to actually find late bloomers. So as one of the architects of this program, a woman named Chelsea Waugh told me, she said, well, we know we have these fast risers, right? Like the kids who develop physically early or whatever it is, and people pay tons of attention to them, but they're like the easiest people to spot and they're the minority. It's the slow bakers, these people that we don't pay attention to who could keep coming around and being like the most important members of our programs and we don't pay any attention to them. So part of the plan was to reform the pipelines so that these people who developed more slowly wouldn't get kicked out prematurely. And they could keep themselves in even if they weren't the best early on. And a lot of those people go on to become the world champions and Olympians. In some cases, the UK set up even these so-called talent transfer programs where you could take someone from one sport and just say, you know, you're not really going to make it in this one. You want to try some others. And occasionally things like that would produce Olympians or gold medalists like Helen Glover, who for a while was probably a rower who was probably the most dominant athlete in the world. She got spotted in a talent search in Britain. She won, I think her teammate won the first gold medal for the home team at the 2012 Olympics. She had not rowed as of the previous Olympics ever, right? So this goes really against these 10,000 hours of, well, if you didn't start early, you lost. And I think, some countries that have realized that's not the case have really capitalized on it in diversifying their developmental pipeline to capture some of the late bloomers, which typically make up the greater portion of the people who go to the top.
And you write about a variety of paths to excellence, which all involve the sampling period, what you just described. You sort of sample sports and various things. So I must get you to tell us the story of Duke Ellington. That was just a great example of a different paths.
Yeah,
definitely not starting early.
So. Duke, of course, this came out of my personal interest just because I think he's a jazz musician, through his art, an important social critic at the time. And he creatively reinvented him. Like his most famous work, if you Google it, is stuff from the 30s, this big band music, which honestly sounds a little bit like cheesy to my ear, to the modern ear. But then if you look at his stuff in the 60s that people are less familiar with, it is, you would never know is the same musician. And it is amazing. Like go to YouTube, listen to Florette Africaine with Duke Ellington. It's totally different music and it's very modern and incredible. But he actually had an offer of music lessons when he was a kid from this, I love the name of the teacher he was offered, Marietta Klinkscales. And he decided not to do it because he wasn't interested at the time. He was focused on baseball and painting and drawing. He actually was offered an art scholarship to college, but turned it down. And it was only, it was about 7 years after that, when he was a teenager, where he heard ragtime and said, now that I'm interested in. And then he went to the piano himself and started trying to copy and work things out. And a theme for him became that he wanted to go and immerse himself and sort of try and experiment, and learning by sort of being told do this over and over and over was not the thing for him. And I think that is sort of, in fact, I mean, he became at one time the preeminent creative composer in the United States, and he was still using some of his own made up notation because he had never formally learned like real musical notation, and people had to sort of like transcribe it for him. And that sort of is in line with a lot of research that suggests, look, if you're just looking to try to play classical music, then this huge amount of repetition, absolutely. But if you're looking to create and compose, then sometimes this process that is much slower at the beginning, where you sort of dive in and fail and aren't immersed, and it should be more like the way we learn language, right? Like, you don't get taught grammar first. You jump in and you try and you fail. And later, if ever, you learn the grammar, right? I mean, I'm a writer. I know very little about grammar. It's kind of, well, I'm not embarrassed by it anymore because now, but like, you know, my in-laws sometimes still make fun of me because I don't know like formal rules of grammar. And I'm like, but it's okay. I mean, I'm living as a professional writer, so obviously it's not holding me back in the same way that many of the great jazz musicians either learned to read music late or never learned to read music late. And so when they had to learn early on, it was this much initially slower but more immersive, creative, experimental process that grew very organically into their creativity.
I love that joke that you mentioned in the book. When a jazz musician is asked, can you read music? The answer is, not enough to affect my playing.
Yeah, not enough to hurt my playing. Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
David, it's absolutely fascinating. I want to kind of get into now some of the concepts that all these stories illustrate. So I'm going to rattle through a couple of them and get you to elaborate. So reasoning by broad analogy, so we've touched on that already, that's sort of one of the takeaways. Another takeaway is, and this is very interesting, why you have to set aside expertise sometimes, because there's a problem of deep and specialized expertise. So just kind of talk us through that.
Yeah, so I think one of the problems with expertise sometimes, and again, I don't mean to suggest that we don't need it, but is the overuse of solutions that may have worked in certain situations or that people have gotten used to, even if they don't work anymore. So to give one sort of stunning example, like there some interesting work by an economist recently in two Harvard-led studies that found that In the US, again, this is specific to the US, if you're checked into academic hospitals, so hospitals associated with universities with certain cardiac conditions, like a heart attack, on the dates of a national cardiology convention, when the most esteemed specialists are away, you are less likely to die. And the conclusion the researchers made is that there's a lower rate of these very intensive procedures that specialists are very used to doing over and over, even though the evidence has shown either that they don't work in certain situations, you know, they're dangerous or they're ineffective or both. And yet they keep doing it anyway. And initially this was thought maybe to be these sorts of phenomena to be coupled to compensation, right? But then some institutions tried to decouple the number of times you do a procedure from compensation and it still stayed. So it's a deeper bias. And if you go look in specialist journals, you'll see even when overwhelming evidence contradicts some practice, they'll say, but I've seen it work. Right? Which of course, the reason we have science is because you can't just tell it worked from having seen something work. And so you can get this effect where people do things like without thinking about it really, or in a situation that's changed, or even in spite of evidence. And one of the examples I use later in the book come from a psychologist named Carl Weick, who studied organizations that have to perform under high pressure and high reliability. And so they train really a lot, you know, over and over and over and over to create so-called muscle memory. And then the problem sort of becomes when a situation changes and they do those same things anyway. So something like 80% of commercial air traffic accidents happen because a flight crew sticks to like the familiar procedure, even when to an outsider, it's clear that the situation has changed. Or as like one of his famous examples was in wilderness firefighters, where, you know, they'll either hike in or parachute into a fire and try to dig a trench around it. And they're very elite, you know, highly trained professionals, and they do a really good job, except occasionally something unexpected happens, like a fire jumps from one hill slope to another and starts chasing them uphill. And what he found unusual in those cases is that when there would be a tragedy and there'd be loss of life and bodies would be recovered, they would often still have like 200 pounds of equipment on them, only 50 feet away from where they could have run to safety. And what he learned was that they were unwilling to drop their tools. So he used this phrase, drop their tools, which meant to dispense with your familiar procedures when the situation has changed. But they were so highly trained never to get rid of your tools. Your tools are part of your identity as a wilderness firefighter. They save your life. That even when they were being commanded to do so, drop your tools and run, they would not do so. And they would die holding their tools. And eventually this finding actually led to diversification of training in some of these areas where people have more improvisation built into their training. But he saw this issue of dropping your tools as sort of an allegory for a variety of industries where people continue doing something they're used to, even when the problem in front of them has changed.
Wow. I want to focus on one more aspect, which is grit. Mm-hmm. So you write that grit has two parts, a work ethic and resilience, and a second part, which is knowing exactly what one wants. So tell us the beast story and how that story and grit predicts success better than comprehensive scores and all the kinds of things that we're used to looking at.
Yeah, so grit, like you said, again, just a quick refresher for everyone's probably heard the term, but it's a psychological construct based on a 12 question survey, half the points awarded for persistence of effort, like perseverance, and the other for so-called consistency of interests, you know, knowing what you want to do and just that. And it became really famous with the work of Angela Duckworth, another person I really like, by the way, when she did research at the US Military Academy, so-called West Point, and the grit survey turned out to be a better predictor of who would survive beast, the initial orientation that's very physically and like emotionally rigorous. It was a better predictor than were traditional things like tests of athleticism and standardized tests and, you know, other traditional valuations. And so I think that was a surprise and something that was very interesting. It also turned out to have some predictive value for who would graduate, as did those traditional measures. And so that's an interesting thing to know. The part of it that I critiqued was the point of West Point is not to make these survivors or graduates, it's to make the future leaders of the organization, in this case, the US Army. So they have a 5-year active duty commitment after they graduate, fully funded. And since about the mid 1990s, after those 5 years, almost half of them quit, like on the day that they were allowed. So suddenly these very gritty people are dropping like flies. This phenomenon started really in the mid 90s. So some high ranking officers said, oh, we have a millennial grit problem, you know, like, I don't know, too much avocado toast, not enough mortgages or something. I don't know what the exact idea was, but they thought they had developed a grit problem overnight. And then a group of officers and researchers decided to study the problem and found they had not, in fact, developed a grit problem overnight. Surprise, surprise. They had developed a match quality problem. So they had this traditional structure of you assign someone a career, they can express preferences, but you assign them a career track and they get up or out. And that worked quite well when the rest of our economy was like that, with very little lateral mobility. People had discrete periods of training followed by discrete period of work where they would do the same thing, but then enter the knowledge economy and information economy, and that goes out the window. And now we prize people who can engage in creative problem solving, knowledge creation, who are adaptable. And so these young people start realizing things about themselves in their late teens and early 20s and realize they have no agency over career matching in the Army, so they would leave to do it outside. And first the Army tried to throw money at them. And that didn't work. The ones who were gonna stay took the money, the ones who were gonna leave left anyway, $500 million taxpayer money down the drain. Then they started programs like one called talent-based branching, where instead of saying, here's your career track, get up or out, they pair these cadets with like a coach or like a mentor. They let them sample like 5 different career tracks, reflect on how each one fits them and learn about themselves as they go. 90% of the cadets who went through that talent-based branching program changed their career preference, 90% of them. And that improved retention where money hadn't. And so I think, as one of the researchers in this area told me, when you get fit, it looks like grit. Meaning, if you get people in work that fits their interests and abilities well, they will display characteristics of grit, even if they didn't before. And so it's not that I don't think grit is important, but I think the evidence suggests that there's an even higher return to good match, because people will then display those characteristics of grit anyway. So that was sort of where I think grit is both important, but also some of our extrapolations about it have been, just like with the Tiger Woods story, have been ill-conceived. And by the way, Angela Duckworth, she feels the same way. So I highly recommend Google Summer is for Sampling. It's an edition of her newsletter that came out like a day before my book. And it talks a little bit about some of these misconceptions. So Google Summer is for Sampling, Angela Duckworth.
Lovely. Okay, I'm going to squeeze in one more story for you to tell, because I think it's a great story to wrap up with before I get you to just kind of sum up our takeaways. I want you to tell us the story of the first time CEO, who was also her first professional job at the age of 54, and she never went to college. So you write that uncommon career paths are actually common, and they're not that rare. So it illustrates the importance of short-term planning. So tell us that story and about short-term planning.
Yeah, and she had one semester of junior college. That's it. So this is a woman named Frances Hesselbein, who grew up in sort of industrial town in Pennsylvania. And basically her career strategy, or lack thereof really, was, as she said, do what's needed at the time. So she would volunteer in her community, or her husband had been a military photographer and came back and started a photo store. And she would just sort of, she was the literal jack of all trades. Like if somebody had a weird request, it was like, Frances, just go figure it out. Like I remember one story she told me was someone came in with their dog and said, I want you to take a photo of them, but I want it to look like a painting, you know, like an oil painting. It's like, all right, Frances, go like figure out how to do that. And so she was just this sort of jack of all trades. And in her mid, she started volunteering with the Girl Scouts eventually. And she didn't really want to, but someone from her neighborhood came around and said, look, we're going to have to disband this group of girls unless someone like volunteers to be their leader. And so Frances does it and says, I'll do it for a few months. But then she just keeps doing it and keeps doing it and keeps doing it. And she gets more involved in Girl Scouts. And at age 54, she takes her first professional job as sort of a regional director of the Girl Scouts, basically. And then she just starts every time, she never wants to, she always says no to the things. Every time somebody offers something, she always says no. Like shortly after that, which she had said no to, someone comes to her and says, look, we need you to lead the United Way fundraising campaign for Girl Scouts because it's in disarray. And if you don't, then we're just going to, you know, Girl Scouts are going to lose the partnership. And Frances is like, fine. First she says no. And then she says, well, if they're going to lose the partnership, I'll do it. So she's the first woman to do this. And Johnstown, Pennsylvania, like leads the country in giving that year. And so it's this huge success. And eventually in her 60s, she goes on to become the CEO of the Girl Scouts. Again, something she says no when they ask her, because the previous leaders of the Girl Scouts had been like a woman who started the U.S. Coast Guard Reserve and a university dean, these people with incredible leadership credentials. Frances had one semester of junior college and was one of like 350 regional directors. But again, she sort of decides to do it under a little bit of pressure, and because the organization was tanking. Early 70s, society changing for girls and women a lot, Girl Scouts not changing very much. So it was in a tailspin, losing membership, losing volunteers. She comes in, throws out all the traditional stuff, right? Which was one of the big moves, because they could not, the people who were more steeped in it could not, like they had campsites that people weren't using, but there was so much nostalgic value, they wouldn't get rid of them. And she was like, we gotta save the organization. Rip up the one handbook, make all these handbooks tailored to her target audiences, recreate the leadership team to look like the audience that she wants to serve. As she said, I want, if an indigenous girl on an ice floe in Alaska opens our book, I want her to see herself in a Girl Scouts manual. And again, this is in the 70s. And she saves the organization. She triples minority membership. She adds 130,000 volunteers. She turns the cookie business into a third of $1 billion a year, weathers various crises, changes it from an organization preparing girls for life in the home to one preparing them for careers in math and science. She gave me, it's a podcast, so you wouldn't be able to see it, but a badge that came out of her tenure is binary code for girls learning about computers. And she turned the whole thing around. She changed the hierarchical structure to one she called circular management because she knew she didn't have enough specialty to get all the information she needed. She needed information flowing from more levels of the organization. And after that, she tried to retire. And like 2 days after that, got a call from someone saying, we have an office for you, come take it. You'll figure out what to do later, which is what she had always done in her life anyway. And she started a leadership institute that she still runs, works 5 days a week in Manhattan. And she just turned 105 earlier this month. So Who knows what's next for Francis? But it was, I just used it as this extreme emblematic symbol of this greater research that I profile called the Dark Horse Project, that talks about how people find work that fits them really well. Mm-hmm. And basically the pattern was they could have long-term goals, but if so, they didn't hold to them very tightly. What they really did was say, here's where I am right now. Here are the options in front of me. I'm going to do this one. And maybe a year from now, I'll change because I will have learned something about myself or my options will have changed. And they just keep on doing that over and over, like throughout their lifetime until they find better and better matches. And so she sort of occurred to me as an extreme version of that. And also, frankly, as someone whose story I think deserved a lot more attention. The famous management guru, Peter Drucker, at one point called her the greatest CEO in America. So she deserves more attention.
Great story to end with. But David, before we wrap up, I want you to sum up. What are your tips for those who are tuning in to become a generalist who triumphs?
Yeah. So first, don't worry about being behind, because development is so nonlinear, whether that's physical development or your career development, that our intuition is to see people at a space and time and assume that's a stable trajectory. And that's just not the case. It's almost never the case. So don't feel behind. It doesn't help you. You don't even know where you're going. But I think an approach, like I just mentioned, the Dark Horse Project people, a lot of those people ended up with this incredibly broad skill set. But typically they didn't set out to say, like, I'm going to be a generalist. They set out in search of match quality for their work. And they would go somewhere and find, you only learn about yourself by doing stuff. My favorite quote in Range is from Herminia Ibarra, London Business School professor, said, we learn who we are in practice, not in theory. Like, there's all this personality quiz industry that wants to convince you that you can just look inside yourself and know what to do. And in fact, you have to do stuff and then reflect on how it fits you, what you were good at and bad at. And so these people would take this approach of trying things to figure out about themselves and then pivoting in response to those lessons and that lived experience. And by doing that, they would end up with this, by being curious about themselves and their options, they would end up with these broad skills. And so I would say you don't even have to set out to be a generalist. Be curious, diversify your sources of information, be open-minded, and try to get the maximum amount of learning from each of your experiences about yourself. What surprised you? What interested you that you didn't expect? What were you good or bad at that you didn't expect? That was another surprise in the Army's talent-based branching research. The cadets were often surprised by things that they weren't as good at as they thought they would be, or interested in things they didn't think they would be interested in. And so make sure you make the most of those lessons, and then don't ignore them. Like, pivot in response to them. You know, it's I think everyone wants like a linear looking LinkedIn, you know, but we shouldn't reward people for forging ahead if they learn things that say they should pivot. And in fact, LinkedIn's own research on 500,000 members showed that the best predictor of who would go on to become an executive was the number of different job functions someone had worked at. And yet you could argue that their product might augur against people feeling like they should do that. And so I think we should just don't be scared to try different things. And pivot in response to the things you're learning. Take every different opportunity to try something as an opportunity to learn about yourself and your options. I force myself to do it. I keep something I call a book of small experiments, where I force myself to investigate something new at least every other month. And so I think it'd be good if we all had systems for forcing ourselves to diversify our learning a little bit or try new things. Because once you get competent at something, most people will settle into that thing and keep doing it at a certain level forever. If you want to continually get better, you have to do different things. You can't lift the same weights the same number of times every day and expect to get better. You might not get worse, but you won't get better. So find methods to diversify, don't feel behind, and pivot in response to pay attention to the lessons you're learning, reflect on them, and pivot in response to them.
Great summary. Thank you so much, David Epstein. I encourage everyone to pick up his book, Range, Why Generalists Triumph in a Specialized World. It's a lively read, and there's huge number of just fascinating examples, including one we didn't have time to get to, but I absolutely loved, which was the story of Van Gogh, the painter. And I think once you read the book, it'll inspire you to start thinking differently about your path forward, or paths forward. So thanks very much again to David Epstein, and thank you all for tuning in. For more business podcasts, go to intelligencesquared.com. I'm Linda Yu.